Hello and hi, welcome to another Slice of Sci-Fi. I'm Summer Brooks, and as all of our listeners know, I'm a huge fan of horror, and especially monsters and monster movies, the ones I grew up on, the Godzilla movies. Jaws was an early favorite of mine, having seen that as a child, who should not have been in that theater to begin with. And PBS is a favorite of mine because that was my first exposure to British science fiction like Doctor Who and The Tomorrow People. And they have a new project now that combines everything that I love: monsters, horror, folklore, and literature. They have a new series through their PBS Digital Studios called Monstrum, and the show's host, Dr. Emily Zarka, has probably the coolest educational history I've read in years. Welcome, Emily.
Thank you so much for having me, Summer.
I'm looking here. You have a PhD in Victorian literature with an emphasis on Gothic, but you also dive into...
Actually, British Romantic literature is my specialty.
British Romantic literature.
Yes.
How just narrow that down even more to a more fine
where
specialty.
Where Gothic originated, yeah.
But you also do folklore and horror, and you specialize on monsters.
I do.
I'm reading this. The line that caught my attention was, her research explores the roles of desire and knowledge dissemination in portrayals of undead characters produced during the late 18th and early 19th centuries.
Yes, I have the best job, hands down. My dissertation focused on, undead figures in literature pre-1850.
So you are the go-to person for how do we kill zombies when they come for us?
Yes, I have a zombie pack in the back of my car all the time. I'm ready to go.
Cool. So tell us about Monstrum and how this show came to be. And did you spearhead this? Did you say, we need this?
I did. I pitched PBS. So PBS Digital Studios is always looking for new and exciting, accessible humanities content. And I had started positioning myself as a monster expert in grad school, working on my dissertation about the undead, teaching literature and film courses themed around monsters, and presenting various papers at conferences. And then through the PhD process, I decided that one of my life goals was to be Dr. Emily Zarka, monster expert, on a channel like National Geographic or History. And over time, the response I got to my work and my passion for monsters gave me the confidence to start thinking about, not being an interview on a show, but to be the show, which would allow me to research, do what I love, write what I love, and, make thousands of people my students. So I was lucky enough that the director at PBS Digital Studios was willing to give me, a few minutes of his time, and we had a very delightful video conference call, and I pitched it to him, I remember, as I'm trying to do what Anthony Bourdain did for food with monsters, right? So showing that it's a really cool way to unite different groups throughout history, different communities, different countries, different kinds of people.
This is just the coolest thing I've heard in a long time. And the fact that you're focusing on folklore and undead stories, mythologies, legends from around the world, all of the cultures.
And everything we can.
That just warms my heart because there are so many stories out there. I'm like, okay, we're tired of the elves and the paladins. Can we do something new, please?
Yeah. No, I completely agree. And I think all monsters have meaning and they all have a purpose. But yes, I do think that there's space out there to educate more people about that monsters are something that are universal. They unite us. So yes, part of Monstrum's goals, and we're expanding into that later on in the season this year, of looking at, yes, absolutely, different countries, different communities of people, rural versus urban even, just looking at everything we absolutely can. And I can't really run out of monsters, so if you have a favorite one, I'm sure I'll cover it. Let me know.
Well, was asked not to give any spoilers, but so far the first two full episodes are out. 2 weeks ago you did an episode comparing the White Walkers to the Dragoor from Nordic mythology. And the episode that just came out this week is about the headless horseman myths, the Dullahan. Am I pronouncing that right?
Yes, the Dullahan. Yes.
from Ireland. And I'm told that possibly a chupacabra may make an appearance.
Yes. Again, I'm not trying to give away too many spoilers, but pretty much cats out of the bag on that one. Yes, we are doing a chupacabra episode coming up very soon. And a couple other hints, if anyone wants them, is, you know, look at some of the big movies coming out at the end of May. Some, you know, very famous monsters.
Mm-hmm.
You might, you know, do a little research there. And absolutely, we're filming again very soon, and we're going to have tons of exciting things. Everything from classic literary monsters like Medusa to, you know, some of the more obscure types of monsters.
And your release schedule is one every other week, so you're going to be rolling out new monsters all summer long for people to enjoy. And that's just a delight for me. So our first season has 16 episodes. Did you have to do any traveling, or is everything just produced in the studio?
So everything is pretty much produced in the studio right now. I research and write every episode and then fly to Austin for my wonderful production company, Spotson. And yeah, we have an in-house group there that films, edits, puts everything together. We have an amazing illustrator who's based out of England, who also is part of the team. But I'm hoping that in the future, you know, depending on the success of this first season, to do some filming on location sites. I will be doing a little bit of filming in Ireland, more vlog style. I'm already going there for vacation, about a very famous Irish monster. So I'll give a little hint for that one.
Nice. So what, in this first season, what monsters are you covering that you didn't really dive into during your graduate research?
Pretty much all of them.
Really?
We're going to have, there will be a vampires post-Dracula episode that's coming out. But other than that, we're saving some of my more specialty elements for later, because it's really honestly a joy to have the opportunity to go beyond what I've studied so far. So, oh, yes, lots and lots of research. But I love it.
What kind of approach do you take to creating an episode? Like, how do you pick the monster, and then where do you go digging for information?
Mm-hmm. So it's kind of an effort between PBS and Spotson and myself, but I make up a list of, you know, the top 20 monsters that I want to see done, you know, in the first season or as soon as possible. Then as a group, we discuss, you know, which ones make the most sense. Again, trying to balance out more, you know, well-known, maybe Western monsters with something from a different area, a different country that maybe people aren't as familiar with. And then I go diving into lots and lots of databases, books, films. I'm on the faculty at Arizona State University, and I'm very fortunate to have access to their library and databases. So for an episode I'm working on right now, I'm currently combing through periodicals from the Victorian period.
Now, the newest episode is the Dullahan, the Headless Horseman myth.
Yes.
And I was fascinated because I had no idea of the Irish origins of the, you know, the Washington Irving's Sleepy Hollow Headless Horseman. And I need to just say right up here as a warning to people who have not seen this episode, headless horses too? What?
Yes, headless horses. I know. It's so bizarre. And I almost wish we had seen that in Irving's version. But I think what's really cool about what Irving did with the Dullahan sort of legend that he was undoubtedly exposed to is he did really make it an American monster, you know, adding those elements about the Revolutionary War and some of the fears that that community had, you know, being in New England at the time. But yes, the Celts definitely had headless horses in a lot of the Dullahan legends. And I also love that Dullahan can be both male and female. So, you know, the undead does not discriminate.
I'm sorry, but the horse being headless is, to me, creepier than some guy holding his head in one hand and a sword in another. That's just wrong.
I think, you know what? That's a really good point, because I think we're, in some ways as a society, more used to, I can't believe I'm about to say this, seeing decapitated heads, right, throughout history, the French Revolution, you know, some monsters. Even, you know, Harry Potter has nearly headless Nick with, you know, the head partially hanging off as a ghost. So I think we're kind of familiar with that image. But yes, seeing a headless horse or a headless animal of any kind is more frightening. I agree, because we're just less used to it.
So where did you go searching for more information on different headless people, headless monster myths around the world to tie into that?
Yeah, absolutely. At least for the Dullahan, there are headless myths of horsemen throughout the world, actually, and I'm hoping to sort of explore some of them. And some of them I don't even know about, and I've had some really awesome feedback from commenters on YouTube already saying, oh, check out, you know, the Mexican version, or check out this version. But in terms of the Dullahan, I looked a lot at those early 19th century texts where authors were beginning to collect oral folklore and legends and actually writing them down, sometimes for the first time. So Fairy Legends and Traditions of the South of Ireland was from 1825, was a huge source. There are tons of Dullahan stories in that one, which was great. And then, of course, reading the original, you know, Irving texts and reading reviews about that. And what I really think is fascinating about monsters, what it allows me to do at least, is to look not just at literature, but at oral tradition, to look at the lives of the authors writing these things down, to look at history, politics, even geography, right? And figuring out a little bit of everything, even art history. So I try to bring in as many different interdisciplinary fields as I possibly can to get the biggest impact with each monster.
And I've seen some of the feedback from people on YouTube. The commenters are just loving this. Are you providing like sort of a cheat sheet bibliography? It's like, hey, if you want to find out more about this monster, go to these, you know, check these books out.
Absolutely. If you check out the description on the YouTube page, I list every single source in the bibliography for that episode. Absolutely. Nice. Even stuff that didn't necessarily, you know, make it into the final script version, I put it all there, and I'm always more than happy to answer questions and point people in the direction of at least the sources I used. And of course, maybe hear some cool, new, exciting things from other people, because unfortunately I can't read everything. I try, but I'm always willing to get new sources and hear new things. But that's definitely something that's important to me as an educator, is to have my bibliography up there so people know that, you know, I'm doing the research, I'm trying the best I can, and that they too can, you know, look at some of these really awesome sources.
Hopefully you're going to make librarians all around the country very happy, because people are going to come running in going,
oh my gosh, yes. I always tell my students, I'm like, you should get a public library card, go to the library, look at the books, they're great.
So what so far has been for you the most challenging or the most fun part of creating this show?
I think the most challenging and the most fun have been honestly being on camera. It's not, you know, I'm used to lecturing and talking to classrooms or conferences or, you know, groups of a couple hundred people, but, you know, being on film and exposing yourself to the internet is a completely different experience. So it took a little adjusting, but it's getting a little bit easier. And I do have some on-camera training for my journalism degree at the University of Colorado. But to be honest, it's both challenging and exciting to be, you know, on the internet and to have this huge range of people and audiences that could be watching my videos. And like you said, primarily the feedback has been really awesome so far, and I hope to see more engagement with my audience. I would love to talk about monsters and folklore and, you know, just chat with other people who are into monsters and creepy stuff.
So how did you get in to studying, you know, Victorian Gothic romance and monsters?
Yeah, I know it seems like an odd combination, but it's really not. So at the University of Colorado, where I did my undergraduate degrees, I picked up a second degree in English literature just because I was taking so many electives. I've always loved reading, but it was sort of a why not. And I happened to be taking at the exact same time in the semester a class called Popular Topics Zombies and the history and literature of Georgian England, and being exposed to all these new zombie texts and films, and really kind of thinking about, like, oh my gosh, the undead are not only amazing, I've thought that for a while, but that they do have, you know, a lot of worthiness in scholarship. And I happened to read in that Georgian England class a poem called Christabel by Samuel Taylor Coleridge, and I immediately identified one of the main characters in there, the villain actually as a vampire. And to me, it seemed so obvious. And I wasn't the first scholar to ever do that. But, you know, as a 20-year-old, I was like, oh my gosh, this is actually something I could do. Wrote my semester paper about that. And that spiraled into an honors thesis. And ultimately, the undead in the British Romantic period became my dissertation, my specialty. And the more I did a lot of digging, I firmly believe that, you know, the vampires, maybe even some of the zombies and the mummies and the reanimated corpses we see today take root in the late 18th, early 19th century.
So from what you studied, it's more than just the vampires back then.
Yes, absolutely. The vampire became sort of the popular name. John Polidori is credited with, you know, the first real like English language, the vampire text. But from my research, I actually believe that women, female authors, have a much more impactful role in the creation of the undead that we see today. And I do use undead purposely because, again, the word zombie and even vampire they didn't have the same designation, the same labeling that we do now. So I widened the range to, you know, is it a human corpse that reanimates? Is it corporeal? Can people touch it? Does it, you know, drink blood or do all those kinds of things? And I found some really exciting texts. And I hope to actually explore that. I'm turning my dissertation into a book manuscript. So I'm going to be giving all of that research out there at some point.
So from your studies, and I'm just curious about this for my own thing, are most of the Victorian undead brought back through supernatural means, through magic, through science? What have you found in your research?
It really depends. I would say primarily it's supernatural, but what I think is really unique, at least about the earlier part of the 19th century, is that not the explanation usually isn't even given. You know, sometimes you might have a conclusion at the end that, oh, you know, the creator brought him back, you know, not saying God, but being vague. Sometimes it is science, but honestly, it's usually just a reanimated corpse pops up for whatever reason. The idea of the vampire bite being able to sort of transfer just is starting to come into play at that point, more towards the end of the 19th century. So any corpse could be reanimated. But I think that's really evocative of the period where you have emerging ideas of things like anatomy and biology, and technology is evolving so quickly. You know, you're on the end of the Enlightenment, so all these new ideas are being exposed to people, and I think that was so overwhelming. And also, there's a lot of death, if we think about it, right? French Revolution, American Revolution, we have the Industrial Revolution, various wars of all kinds. So there's an increase in death and in bodies being, you know, buried more visibly in things like cities. So I think with, you know, all this death and all this new information, it seemed more likely that, who's to say, you know, reanimated corpse can't pop up out of nowhere.
I remember reading somewhere that was a reason for the bells in the cemeteries.
Yes.
Like they accidentally buried people who weren't quite dead yet, and they had a bell tied to their hand to go, hello, still here.
or tied to their toe. Yeah, their big toe. And that actually predates the 1800s. That was a practice that we've always had a fear as humans, I think, of accidentally burying someone who is alive, which is terrifying in so many ways. But again, before we really have the science to determine, yes, this person's heartbeat has stopped, yes, this person is brain dead, you sort of did your best with guessing. And sometimes, unfortunately, I think they did get it wrong, right? Some people were probably, it was probably a very small margin, but some people were likely buried, let's say, when they weren't completely gone yet, which is terrifying.
So the history of humanity being afraid of the dead bodies, the things that cause death, where in your studies have you seen possibly a source for this, like a death number, you know, patient zero, a death zero that, that just freaked everybody the hell out?
I can't give you one. The reason being is I think that not every culture that I've looked at, but the majority of societies across the globe and throughout history have some kind of undead legend. Usually the ones who do not are areas where cremation is, you know, practiced, right? Because how can you have a reanimated body if the body's not even there anymore? But I think that what the fear of the undead that we share as humans is that they so closely resemble us, right? It's not a werewolf that, you know, has animalistic elements, or it's not some other crazy monster that seems so inhuman or vaguely human, like a dragon, right? But rather, it's literally the body of someone you might have personally known and loved could be knocking on your door again one day. And I think that idea is scary because it directly forces us to confront our own deaths, right? We will all eventually be those same corpses, those same dead bodies. So having it presented to us so vividly with a walking corpse just really hits the nail on the head with that human fear of death and also confronting death.
And
ideas of the afterlife, right?
Because
in different texts that I've read, sometimes the undead do still have their souls, like the Draugr, and sometimes they don't. Sometimes the loss of the soul is, you know, even the reason why the undead is reanimated. So I think that the idea of afterlife is also really important. You know, what does happen after death? And for some, that may be, you know, being a shambling corpse walking around. That's scary that, you know, right, is what we would be end up as. You know, the idea that there's no rest or no better existence, but just coming back out of the ground and walking around.
Hmm. So if your dead body is shuffling around the planet, does that mean that your soul, which has gotten back in line to get on this ride mm-hmm. again, can't be reborn? Hmm.
It depends. Yeah, it's different cultures have different ideas about that with the undead. And that's one of the reasons we see actually differences in how the undead both act and how they actually are created or reanimated.
Do you think that fascination with what death really means is why mm-hmm. these monsters are so popular all over the world?
I do think that's a large part of it. And again, I think that because we are human, the monster that looks most closely like us is going to immediately be more popular just because, you know, we have limited imaginations. And of course, there are monsters out there that, you know, barely resemble anything even that's, you know, carbon-based life. But having the, and people would also with things like wakes, right, or on battlefields, we see dead bodies. So I think it's really easy in our minds to reanimate that body because at one point we might have seen it walking around in life or one that looks like it walking around. We ourselves are walking around.
Hmm. Now, in the episodes that have come up so far, the Draugr and the Dullahan, your animation team has gotten really creative with not only just showing historical photographs and maps and drawings, mm-hmm. but also animating them in sort of a modern Monty Python sort of way.
Yeah.
What
I like that.
The sources for these pictures, mm-hmm. these are from the mm-hmm. original publications back in the day, right?
Yeah. So we use basically three kind of major clips besides me on screen, right? So we have, again, our wonderful illustrator who, Samuel Allen, and he's amazing and was something that we actually, and I approached the show with, that I think having the illustration would be really important because sometimes we're talking about monsters or I'm talking about monsters that we don't have what I think at least is an accurate representation of that creature that's been visually portrayed yet. So we work together as a team. The illustrator, again, is amazing. And come up with something original. And that's something unique to our show that I really enjoy. So we have that. Then yes, the team and myself, as I'm going along in my research, we do source image from original illustrations, paintings, book covers, the actual text these things are coming from, sometimes fossils, artifacts. And then when relevant, we have, you know, fiction book titles, covers, excuse me, or, you know, clips from movies to really try to show the connection between what we see now or what we're familiar with and historically what that monster has been like.
Because just watching the episode of the Draugr, seeing the one little segment where you've got one of them jumping around on the roof in anger, I'm like, angry Santa, cool.
Yeah, right? I mean, that's such a bizarre thing. Yeah, the roof riding, and that pops up in so many of the Draugr texts. And again, not necessarily as scary as it being able to, you know, strangle you to death, because usually Draugr are very strong, but the irritation, right? That factor, too, I think is fascinating.
So how many undersea monsters are you covering in season one, or can you say yet?
In season one, I can tell you right now, we have one that is a very famous sea monster, And the other one, this ocean comes into play in maybe a way some people wouldn't expect. I'll say that.
Okay.
I would say two.
How different are the sea monsters? Because, I mean, if you think about it, that's kind of a gothic monster. You have people sailing around the world for the first time in mass after centuries of, well, he took a boat and we haven't seen him again, so we figure he got eaten. The legends coming back. You've got the white whale. You've got the giant sea monsters that can actually, the tentacles pull the ships underwater. Where do those fit into your gothic literature niche?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that the 19th century has a ton of sea monster stuff. Some really famous ones, right? Like Moby Dick, 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea, all that stuff is popping up in that period. But I think that sea monsters, like all sort of animal monsters, are terrifying because they remind us of the predators that are actually out there. Because you're absolutely right. We have these soldiers, or, you know, these sailors, rather, sailing around the world before, you know, sometimes it was barely a thing that the world was even considered round at this point, right? Sometimes the ship doesn't come back, or maybe someone is thrown overboard and then suddenly disappears in like a cloud of blood from a shark or something. And again, I think our imagination fills in the gaps of what we don't understand. And you'll see that in some of the upcoming episodes. There's some really interesting fossil records that give us some hints about why certain sea creatures, sea monsters exist. And also there's some really interesting things about like maps. If you look at the older maps, like 13th to 15th century, they'll have these little illustrations of various kind of crazy sea creatures. Because one thing, and I think the reason why we still fear sea creatures in so many ways, is that we know less about our deep ocean than we do about our solar system. So in my perspective, I think that the oceans on Earth are still so vastly uncharted in terms of at least depth that we don't really know what's down there. There could be some crazy prehistoric things down there. And I think that there are. That's just my personal opinion.
I have a friend who swears that Cthulhu is lurking and all of these beachings, like you've got the dolphins and the whales and these larger and larger cephalopods, they come out, their bodies are larger, their tentacles are larger. He's like, he's testing our defenses. You just wait.
I like that. And I mean, I don't think there's anything wrong with believing in monsters to a certain degree. I like to say that monsters not only tell us about our own human history, but about us personally. Not only are we ultimately the creators of monsters, the ones that come up with the folklore and the stories and the movies, but we are the ones who, you know, are still afraid of things that maybe go bump in the night, or, you know, maybe you're worried about the environmental impact that, you know, we're having on the world. And fear is something that is both exciting in that it, you know, raises our adrenaline, our heart rate. But I think also in a lot of ways, monsters and horror, the gothic, sci-fi, what have you, help prepare us at least psychologically for what would happen, you know, with a disaster. And I mean, the zombie apocalypse is a great example of this. You know, even the CDC has a zombie plan in place that they release to the public. Not necessarily because they think that, you know, reanimated human corpses are going to go around trying to eat people's brains, but because it's a really good intellectual exercise to think about how would, you know, the individual deal with a bioweapons attack or even a major drought or some other kind of natural disaster.
Yeah, the one story that freaked me out came out of Florida, I'm thinking maybe 4 or 5 years ago.
Yeah.
The guy who was on some sort of synthetic drug who started eating a guy's face and the tasers wouldn't take him down. I'm like, all righty there. That's sign number one of the apocalypse coming. See ya.
Right. That's where part of this, you know, cannibalism is still a thing in some areas of the world. It was a thing. And rabies, other, you know, psychoses can cause people to try and eat other humans. So we have various monsters that pop up from that. Not only vampires and zombies, but things like werewolves.
Yeah, there was an episode. Do you remember the TV show Through the Wormhole with Morgan Freeman?
No, I don't think I've heard of that.
It was on Science Channel. Discovery Channel or Science Channel, one of the two. And he did an episode about zombies, the history of zombies, and the premise that the trigger for turning humans mm-hmm. into zombies could be the rabies virus becoming mm-hmm. airborne.
Yeah,
they did a whole scenario about that, and talking to scientists is like, yeah, if that happens, we're gone, we're done. I'm like, lovely.
Right. There are so many small things, you know, microbes, bioweapons that we don't understand or can't control. And that's also where I think a lot of that sort of science-based fear comes from.
Mm-hmm.
But hopefully season 2, I don't know if I'm allowed to say this yet, but I will. We're going to have hopefully a special series about different types of zombies and the history between behind each one.
Nice. Nice. So what are you actually teaching in your classes, and how does that carry over to mm-hmm. the things you're including in the show?
Yeah, absolutely. So it depends on the classes that I do teach. Currently, at least this much, I'm teaching primarily composition classes, but I've taught a Humanities Universal Themes class that had a monsters unit. I've also taught film and literature hybrid courses where we look at, you know, maybe the original Frankenstein and then different interpretations in film and in literature. Or we look at more, you know, human type monsters, you know, more serial killer based things. And I think my personal opinion is that students respond to professors that are really passionate about whatever it is they're talking about. And for me, that just happens to be monsters and the gothic and horror and sci-fi. And I think that presenting them with a class, when you say, hey, look, we're going to talk about, you know, the evolution of the female monster, they're going to sign up for it because it sounds cool. But then once they're in the classroom, I'm going to sneak in all this, you know, gender theory and history and science and a bunch of other things. So monsters are just an excellent entry point to get people interested in thinking about larger concepts. And so I integrate that in my classroom, some more obviously than others. But also I think what monsters can show us is they're a clear line of looking at, you know, maybe a painting that's inspired by a poem, and then that painting becomes something that we see in a film. So showing the connection of how texts talk to one another is pretty easy to see in different kinds of monsters.
I think that'd be kind of a cool class to actually show the source material for mm-hmm. a monster or a myth, and show, you know, compare it to the different versions that you've seen on television or mm-hmm. in the movies, because there's, you know, there's some creative license taken to adapt certain things to the screen, but seeing how close they stay to the original or how mm-hmm. far away they go from it,
mm-hmm.
that I think that speaks to our need to tell stories and just change the stories enough mm-hmm. so that they resonate more with ourselves. And
exactly. No, I completely agree. I think that while we still see some types of monsters, some certain patterns, the thing that does change, yes, is sometimes the meaning behind it or even the way it looks based on the current cultural fears, right? I think that what's different throughout history is maybe the medium in which the stories are told. And sometimes the meaning of the monster itself changes, but it does so to better suit the people and the time in which it's being presented. I did do that again with Frankenstein for a film adaptation class. So I had them read the original Shelley text. And then we also looked at Ghost in the Shell and Penny Dreadful's interpretation of Frankenstein, as well as an amazing comic series called Victor Lavelle's Destroyer, which were all so good, right? All completely different modern interpretations. And then we tried to find the differences and the similarities. And then I challenged them to say, okay, well, why? You know, why is, you know, maybe Frankenstein's creature in Ghost in the Shell, both the manga and the Western version, you know, more tech-based, like an android? So we talk about how themes maybe remain the same, but how those are visually portrayed changes.
Now, do you do any research into why certain myths or elements of folklore disappear? Because I know that, I don't remember how long ago it was, but that like somebody dug up a different version of Beowulf, if I remember correctly.
Oh, I hadn't heard of that. Okay, interesting. Yeah, sometimes I do, and I touch on that more in some episodes on Monstrum than others, and at least in my research, I mean, one thing about the research for every script, right, is it's a video that's less than 10 minutes, usually less than 8, but I might have 22 to 30 pages of notes. So even if it doesn't come out on the screen, I still am thinking about those things. And I think a lot of what happens with monsters or certain versions of monsters that get lost throughout history hopefully to be uncovered, is visibility, right? It's who the author is, how popular the text was at the time that it originally is produced. Because if it's not successful, then you're going to have, you know, less copies of it, less viewers, what have you, and then it sort of falls by the wayside. The most persistent monster stories are the ones that are picked up by a variety of different types of creators and portrayed in different kinds of mediums. That's what I think we see, at least so far.
I would love nothing more than to see a new kind of monster. And I think, you know, you were mentioning kaiju earlier.
Yes.
I think they're going to be doing that with the new Godzilla movie coming out this summer. And the trailers for that just make me want to cry because those are my monsters.
I'm so excited.
Those are my monsters.
Yes. I am with you. I love Mothra. Mothra is my queen. I'm obsessed with Mothra. She's hands down my favorite kaiju. But yeah, I'm with you on that. I think the kaiju are some of the best monster creature films that we have out there because there is so much variety. I mean, you have Space Godzilla, right, with the crystal shoulder pads and the lasers and the craziness. But I love all that. I love that.
And I just love how, in a way, they're sort of new monsters because most of them are created because of man's interference with nature.
Yeah.
And just the fertile monster, the imaginations that created those. Okay, man's messing up the planet. Let's create new monsters that result from that. And there's just, you have this whole large range of gorgeous monsters. And where do you think our next new monsters might come from?
Oh, that's a hard question. I think I'm kind of with you on the kaiju. I think we're going to see, actually, I have a couple theories, because I don't think it's ever going to be one like main type of monster we see. I do think that with the Godzilla, the Monsterverse resurgence, we're going to see more of that again, which, like you, I'm all about. Even something like The Mist, right, which is an older Stephen King story and then movie. It's, you know, exactly some kind of science experiment or nuclear testing or what have you, you know, raises a creature from the deep and mutates it. So I think we're going to see some of that. I do think we also are starting to see, especially in streaming services a lot, the idea of technology becoming monstrous, right, with artificial intelligence. Not necessarily robots, though that's part of it, but, you know, having an all-knowing computer that decides, you know, hey, maybe humans aren't the best thing for the planet. And I do think we see a lot of horror right now, and sci-fi even, looking at the idea that either nature itself is trying to, you know, cull or cut down on the overpopulation, or that humans are doing that on purpose. But I've also seen a really interesting shift again back into cults, like pagan cults, in horror, at least in film and in some comics as well. I don't want to give away too many because sometimes, you know, that's not revealed until later in the film. But I would say within the last 5 years, and I think we're going to see it in some films this year as well, is the idea of there being some pagan religion or god, right? Some older force that people are following and causing them to do monstrous things.
Ah, the Grey Goo premise. Yay.
Yeah.
Ugh. It's just, it seems so simple. And then you realize, oh, wait, that's not good.
Yes. Yeah.
So what else are you looking forward to with this series?
With Monstrum, I'm really looking forward to just keep expanding. Not only the types of monsters, but where we source the monsters from, right? Looking at different continents, different countries to really expose people to as many global monsters as possible. I'm excited to keep expanding my audience and viewership. So I can not only have more, what I like to say, like students, curious individuals, but so that those people can start talking to one another. One of the goals we have with PBSDS and myself with Monstrum is to get the audience engaged. We want people to be talking in the comments. We want them to, you know, be tweeting, to even be doing fan art, all those kinds of things. We hope that with the episodes, we'll not only educate our audience, but that we'll also get them thinking to, you know, create their own monsters or to look more consciously back at what they're afraid of. So I'm really looking forward to that kind of engagement.
Cool. Well, Emily, Dr. Zarka, thank you so much for
thank you
sharing
so much.
Your passion for monsters with us today.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been great talking monsters.
Okay, the show is Monstrum, Monstrum. Search for that on YouTube. We will have links. It's also on the PBS.org website, and I think the videos are also on Facebook.
Yes, they are on Facebook Watch as well.
So everyone, go leave comments, watch the films, dive into the bibliographies, because I think that is going to serve everybody the best, to watch the little story about a particular monster and then go look at the source material and dig, you know, yeah, a little deeper yourself. But because that's what I love, just finding out something yeah cool and then having a pathway or a doorway to go
absolutely
deeper for myself.
And I love that too. I'm always about new interpretation. So ultimately, Monstrum is my interpretation, but I'm always excited to, you know, hear about how other people, once they look at the source text, right, what do they think? I love that kind of free moving interpretation. So yes, reach out to me on Twitter in the comments. I would love to chat monsters.
Awesome. Awesome. What's your Twitter handle?
My Twitter handle is @ZarkaEmily.
Awesome. We'll have links to that and to the YouTube page, and hopefully people can start, shall we say, edifying, enriching their monster knowledge by yes the knowledge that you're sharing. Again, thank you so much for today.
Thank you so much for having me.
And we'll be back with more Slice of Sci-Fi right after this.
Slice of Sci-Fi.
Hey, you. Stop hiding behind that sofa. Come out from back there. Your sofa wants to talk to you, wants to play footsie with your mind. Listen to it. Relax. Let it in. Starship Sofa, the first podcast ever to win a Hugo Award, with weekly stories from the world's best authors, Michael Moorcock, Peter Watts, Joe Haldeman, Peter F. Hamilton, and many, many, many more. With news and reviews and interviews. Bradbury, Pole, Wolfe, and Mieville, the sofas chewed the fat with them all. Facts and fictions, articles and particles. Oh, why aren't you listening? StarshipSofa.com. Your best science fictional fix this side of the coffee table.
This is Stephen Kilpatrick, host of Tales to Terrify, and you're listening to Slice of Sci-Fi.
And before people start emailing me or leaving me voicemail messages, yes, I realize I made an error. It wasn't the Beowulf poem that recently had some new verses discovered. It was Gilgamesh. So I corrected myself on that. And I will send Emily an email with that link. It was about 5 years ago, give or take, when that was discovered. All sorts of fun stuff. And I don't even know if that zombie episode of Through the Wormhole is online anywhere, but I will look. And if it is, I will link to it. Actually, if I remember correctly, the segment where they talk about the dangers of the rabies virus becoming airborne might actually be in a article on Slice of Sci-Fi. Gonna have to go look for that too. But in any event, the link to the YouTube channel for Monstrum is in the show notes. Definitely go to it or search for Monstrum on YouTube. Follow that particular channel. Like I said, so far they've posted two episodes, the Dragoor and the Dullahan. The Dullahan episode came out this week, so the next episode should come out in 2 weeks. And I am very much looking forward to seeing what the topic of discussion will be when we get closer to the release of the new Godzilla movie, which I can't wait for. Anyway, we do have more interviews with independent film creators of both the science fiction and horror variety, so stay tuned for that. And there are also some new story narrations read by yours truly coming up soon. And yes, one of them is at Tales to Terrify, who you heard a promo for earlier. If you like podcasts filled with horror short stories of various flavors, Tales to Terrify is a good start. There's also Pseudopod, which is part of the Escape Artists stable of shows. Disclaimer, I do a lot of audio producing for Escape Pod, the science fiction short story podcast, also from Escape Artists. So yeah, when the Tales to Terrify story is up, I will let people know. And if you have a chance, check out, like if you have HBO and you want something to look at in between episodes of the final season of Game of Thrones, check out the miniseries Folklore. I think it goes well with Monstrum, and I enjoyed it. So I'm recommending folks check out Folklore. If you have any questions or comments on mythology, monsters, myths, folklore, legends, and such, please feel free to call. The number is 602-635-6976. You can leave a voicemail message, and I'll play it on the show if you allow me to. If you don't, just say so. Or you can send me an email, summer@sliceofscifi.com. Ask your questions. Present your case for something science fiction, paranormal, supernatural, horror, comic book. If there's something out there you'd like me to take a look at as a potential interview, that's a good way to let me know. You can listen to Slice of Sci-Fi on iTunes, on Google Play, on Stitcher, and TuneIn, and also Player FM. If you are listening through iTunes or Stitcher, please leave us a review. Let other folks know you're enjoying the show, and maybe they should check it out for themselves. You can follow us on Twitter, @SliceOfSciFi. You can check out our video programming over on YouTube. We're Slice of Sci-Fi over there. And yes, Noah and Darren's review of Avengers Endgame is up, and we will be adding some content, hopefully very soon, from AwesomeCon in DC, which is also this weekend. And of course, you can come to the website, sliceofscifi.com, weigh in on the interviews we've done and on any of the reviews we've done as well. I'd like to thank everyone for supporting our efforts here. Your donations through PayPal and your pledges through Patreon really do help to keep things online here. If you would like to add your support, you can go to patreon.com/sliceofscifi, or just do a one-time donation every now and then through PayPal using paypal.me/scifisummer. I also like to throw a shout out to my favorite geek rock band, Sci-Fried, for providing the theme music here. If you want to find out more of the music they're composing and parodying, go to their website, sci-fried.com. But that'll do it for this episode. Thank you all for listening, and we will be back with more Slice of Sci-Fi next week. Take care.